I think we are good to go. So, welcome, Mary. How's it going?
It's going great. Thanks for having me on.
Awesome. Yeah, anytime. I actually met you a couple years ago when I first, I think it was like a candidate training in San Antonio, Texas. I don't know if you remember that.
Yes.
But so that was actually like, I had just kind of got introduced to the Libertarian Party, and they were like, yeah, we need as many candidates as we can. And so they convinced me to run, and that's when I met you. And I actually bought one of your earlier books, Short Answers to Tough Questions. And long story short, now I'm like all crazy into the Libertarian Party. So so it was definitely a good book. And I think that it had a lot of great perspectives, because I know, like, libertarians, we get asked all these questions, like, who's going to build the roads? And I think that really had a lot of interesting perspective on that. So thank you for writing that. So now, I guess, let's talk about your new book. So you actually have a new book out that you just published this year, right?
That's right. Death by Regulation, How We Were Robbed of a Golden Age of Health and How We Can Reclaim It.
Awesome. So tell me a little bit about this, because regulation mm-hmm. is, someone posted the other day, if you, what did they say? You might not think government plays a big part in your life, but try to start a business or build something on your own property and you'll see pretty quickly.
That's right. Well, you know, of course, I was a pharmaceutical researcher for 19 years. And during that time, the 1962 amendments to the Food and Drug Act were really kicking in. And these are kind of open-ended regulations, so they metastasize every year. And we started to joke, it was kind of gallows humor, but we started to joke that we no longer had any time to discover new drugs and new cures and therapies because we were so busy meeting the regulations, which grew every year, that we simply didn't have time to actually find something new. And, you know, those amendments took the time that it takes to get a drug from the lab bench to the marketplace from 4 to 14 years. So as you might imagine, a lot of people died waiting. And if you saw the Dallas Buyers Club movie, mm-hmm. you saw what happened to the AIDS patients. They were trying to import drugs from overseas that we didn't have here yet in the U.S., they were selling supplements and vitamins, and they even hired black market chemists to make the same drugs that we were working on in the pharmaceutical industry. And by the time the FDA finally gave us permission to put those drugs in people, every AIDS patient in the country who wanted them had already had them and were resistant to them. So we had to wait for new people to be diagnosed with AIDS before we could do the FDA mandated testing. And because there's been so much work done on the pharmaceutical industry and the impact of drugs, you can actually do a pretty good calculation about how many people have died waiting for new drugs. It's about 15 million people since the 1962 amendments were passed. And of course, when you have that great of a time period, the cost rises, and it's rising exponentially every year. So innovation is also limited. I mean, I even had the FDA call me up one time and say, Dr. Ruart, we're all excited about your research because we understand you've just filed a patent for prostaglandins and liver disease. And there's nothing for liver disease. 100,000 people die every year. So we want to tell you that we're here to help you get this drug to market. And I was, at the time, I was young and naive, so I thought that would change things. But it really didn't, because according to their own regulations, there has to be two studies done in the U.S. with a certain level of statistical significance. And the problem, when you really have something totally new, then you don't know how much drug you need to give. You don't know how many times a day you need to give it. You don't know how long you need to give it, you know. Liver disease is something that builds up over time, and so we didn't know how long we'd have to treat to reverse it. So if you don't guess right on all of these parameters the first time, then you don't get the statistical significance, and you have to start over. And if you have to start over, at least according to our calculations, by the time we actually got the drug to market, if we had to repeat studies, you know, the drug would be going generic the first day it was on the market. There would be no possibility of recovering our development costs. So the company decided they would not develop that drug. They would not put it on the market. And that's pretty sad, because subsequent human trials suggested that it probably would have had a good chance of working. So about, you know, this is a very conservative estimate that I'm giving you, about 26 million people in America have died because of this loss of innovation. And, you know, this is just in the U.S. So this is, like I said, it's a rather conservative calculation. And what that means is it's cost each of us about 5 to 10 years of our lives, or half of us about 10 or 11 years of our lives. And so everyone's affected. And probably the biggest concern I have with the amendments is the fact that they shifted our medical paradigm from inexpensive prevention to expensive treatment. And my guess is that these numbers would be doubled by the time you factor in the prevention. But I can't do the calculation for that, because there haven't been enough studies done. I can only say, at least for the drug industry, we've probably lost, because we don't have the innovative new drugs, 5 to 10 years of our lives.
Wow. So now these drugs, so these are like U.S. laws. So you're saying these drugs were not created because it wasn't profitable. Could they have been created in another country?
Well, in some cases they were, at least initially, because the regulations there were not as strict. But unfortunately, since half the drugs are discovered in the United States, you know, other countries have been affected too. You know, the lack of innovation here ripples out into the world. And the other very scary thing about this whole thing is, even though there's been no increases in safety and effectiveness from pre to post amendment drugs, you know, the prices have gone up about 20 to 40 fold and are still increasing. So it's really very scary. And I haven't even talked about the censorship of life-saving information that also happens. So it's, like I said, it's a very scary thing. And basically what it tells us is that bad regulations can be just as deadly as bad drugs.
Wow. Yeah. And so now, like, I've heard, they use this term, what do they call it, for like there's a movement to basically be able to tell terminal patients that if they want to try an experimental drug, that they have the right to do that. And I can see where it's kind of double-edged, because like the government is quote unquote there to protect us from these evil corporations that are just going to, you know, make powdered chalk and say it's the life-saving pill and sell it to us. And so like they're okay. Yeah. They're trying to protect us from that, supposedly. But at the same time, it's like, if somebody's like in a position where like they don't really have many options, it's almost like, okay, you're just going to buy all the snake oil you can. But now these people are kind of becoming criminals because the snake oil is illegal.
Yeah. Well, and of course, you know, snake oil, it's really funny. Snake oil was actually very beneficial because it had some of the same properties as fish oil. But when they've done studies with snake oil and fish oil, what they found is snake oil has some kind of property that really increases the endurance in rats that are, you know, put in water and they have to swim continually. Basically what happens is the fish oil rats get exhausted faster than the snake oil rats. So snake oil did have some good properties. And if you weren't taking your cod liver oil every day, it probably could have helped you. So sometimes I have to chuckle when people talk about the snake oil, because it's actually very beneficial. So So, you know, time, of course, back in the days of snake oil, we didn't have the science we have today to make those tests, but
that's interesting.
Yeah, you're talking about right to try, which actually President Trump did sign into law just, I think it was last Wednesday. And the thing about right to try, let me just explain a little bit about it. You know, the cancer patients didn't want to do what the AIDS patients did. They didn't want to be prosecuted and persecuted by the FDA, so they sued the FDA and said it's our constitutional right to life, so we should be able to take unapproved drugs if we think it will help us. And they lost that suit. And so Right to Try is the reincarnation of that lawsuit. And it was passed state by state. About 40 states passed it before it got to Congress. And the scary thing about it, though, is that one of the requirements for a Right to Try drug is it has to still stand the FDA's good graces. And having worked in the pharmaceutical industry, I can tell you that a lot of drug companies are going to be very hesitant to work with terminally ill patients and give them or even let them buy their drug, because the FDA might want to punish them for working, you know, going around them, and might very well drag their feet in granting other drug approvals to that company. So they're going to be very hesitant to work under Right to Try. But there is another initiative coming up from the Heartland Institute, which, as you know, is a libertarian nonprofit in Chicago. And they're going to promote free to choose medicine, which actually is similar to Right to Try, except that once the drug is in the free to choose medicine track, it does not have to stay in the FDA's good graces. It has to get to a certain point, have, you know, human safety testing and just the first human study for effectiveness, but that's fairly early in the clinical plan. So it's probably about, I'm going to say it's going to be about a third to a half the way through the process. And and the second half is the most expensive. So if free to choose medicine passes, then we will have the opportunity to have two separate tracks, and we'll be able to actually see how effective it is to have drugs that go into the free to choose medicine track earlier than they would have been approved by the FDA. So it'll be a good test.
Wow, that's really interesting. And it still sounds like extremely complex. Like it's, I mean, it's still like ultimately it feels like it's out of our hands. So it's, you know, it's still between the drug companies and the FDA to kind of sort this out. And there's not like anything, it still feels like we don't have a choice. Like we're, the drug companies are still being limited in what they can produce. And they're being possibly manipulated by how they're going to handle these other rules and all these other things. So it still sounds pretty scary.
Well, it is more difficult. I mean, I think the way to proceed, and I recommend a death by regulation, is that we basically stop making FDA approval a requirement for marketing. Instead, we should have certification, and the FDA can be a certifying agency if it wants to. It can express its opinion, but it's really up to the consumer or the patient, hopefully in collaboration with their doctors, as to what stage of development they actually take a drug. Obviously, if you're terminally ill, you'll be probably taking drugs a lot earlier because you don't have much time. If it's a drug that, you know, maybe just you use to stop your skin from wrinkling, you might want to wait a little while until a lot of people have taken it, because every drug has side effects, and every drug also has, it's not effective for everyone. And yet every drug is effective for some people, even if it's the placebo effect. The placebo effect's pretty high. It's about, depending on who you talk to, it's about 30%. So most terminally ill patients will have a pretty good chance of having at least a placebo effect in some of these studies.
Wow, that's, when you say placebo, so like what's, like you just said something about placebo and like cancer patients. What is there, like, actually, like, are there cancer patients that like get cured by placebo? Like, is that?
Yes.
Really?
Yes. In fact, there's one of the examples that's often used when talking about placebos is a cancer patient that took an experimental drug, and the doctor, you know, told him it was a new potent drug, and he took it, his cancer went away. And then later, a few years later, the FDA said, no, this drug doesn't work. And when the guy heard that, he got his cancer back and died. And so, you know, that's kind of a standard story in the placebo world. But, you know, the FDA requires placebos. So if you're doing a study with cancer patients, half of them or some fraction of them will get placebo and the others will get the actual drug. And so what you're comparing when you look at effectiveness of drugs is usually effectiveness higher than placebo. And that's because everybody recognizes that placebos do work. So there's no drug that doesn't work at all,
That's
even if it works by the placebo effect.
really interesting. So, because it's like I've always been like told like I guess I got that from my mom. She was like always into how powerful your mind is when it relates to your body and how it's really fascinating. So like we you have a disease in your body and that's let's say it's the result of the chemistry of your body. And so what you try to do with medicine is you create a chemical that goes into your body that's supposed to counteract that. But it's like if depending on your actual mindset, it sounds like the placebo is basically tricking your body into reproducing that same
It can't.
effect.
Yeah, we don't really understand the placebo effect very much because, and you know, we should, because if we can cure ourselves, it would be really good to know how to do that, right?
Right. Well, I don't think the doctors are going to like that if they can't prescribe you anything, but they just tell you, oh, just go home and relax and it'll go away. Just think about it really hard.
We would like to see that, right? We would like to know how the placebo effect works, and it's too
Right.
bad studies aren't done about that.
Yeah, absolutely. I think like that's really fascinating. And to see that the percentages are that high. Like I never thought they were that high. Like I thought they were, like 5 or 10% or something, but that's really fascinating. So, what else is in this book?
Well, basically, the bottom line of the book is that, you know, this is really, I think, maybe the best demonstration of how regulations backfire. And it's not the first time this has been put together. I mean, there were some early studies after the 1962 amendments showing that the number of people that could possibly be saved by them was much lower, than one would think. And in fact, there was, about four times as many people were actually harmed by the regulations as were saved by the regulations at best. So early researchers had already figured this out. The reason I did this is because there's been so much work since then that it's actually possible to do a pretty good estimation of how many people have died or have lost years of their lives. And I thought it would be a good demonstration because one of the things that people always point to when they talk about regulations saving us is FDA regulations. So here is an instance where it's actually pretty easy to show that these regulations are detrimental. And other studies have shown, for example, that the more stringent that the licensing laws are for electricians, if you look state by state, the more people die of accidental electrocutions. And that's because when you have a lot of licensing restrictions, then fewer electricians are in your state. And so they can charge higher prices. And when they do that, the poor, especially, who can't afford to bring in an electrician at these high prices, say, well, either I'll do it myself or do without. And that's where they get into trouble.
Wow.
So that's, yeah, so that, so licensing laws can backfire. And the same for optometrists. In states that have more restrictive licensing laws for optometrists, there's more blindness. So regulations can actually do something other than what they were intended to do. And that's because regulations take away consumer choice, whereas certification, allows the consumer to choose. And what happens under certification is you have more practitioners of good quality giving service at a very reasonable price. And so there's more quality service delivered. And so certification really works a lot better than regulation.
Right, that's really awesome. So, I've kind of had this, people ask me now that I have this page, Taxation is Theft. How would we function without the FDA and these sort of things? And it's interesting because that's kind of, I know there are some libertarians that are like, yeah, we just need to shut the government down overnight. And my philosophy has always kind of been like, no, with something like the FDA, we need to make it more of like, instead of shutting it down, allow it to become competitive for some sort of transitional period. And that's kind of like what it sounds like you're talking about, like where it's not mandatory anymore, it's optional. And then you have the ability for like other companies to come up and offer the same certification, and maybe they're better, they have better guidelines, you know, whatever it is that companies are going to choose to be certified by, one or the other or both. And anyone who's shopping around is going to say, I'm only going to buy from companies that are certified by this certification company.
Yes. And of course, if you really love the FDA and you want to wait until they're done with all of their requirements and they give their opinion, you can do that too. And that way everybody's happy. You know, you're not forced to listen to a certifier. You can listen to the FDA if you want. Right. It's just, you can't force your neighbor to do it.
Right. So I have a question that you might be able to answer, because I've kind of been told that there's some sort of protectionism for the pharmaceutical companies by the FDA, where if they create a drug and the FDA approves it, that kind of protects them from lawsuits. So if their drug is actually going out and killing people, they basically can just stand behind and say, oh, but it was FDA approved, so we can't be held liable. Like, it's just a known side effect that some people are going to die. Is there any truth to any of that?
No, not really, because if somebody really does want to sue, they can. Normally that doesn't happen unless there's a big problem with the drug, like Vioxx, for example. There were a lot of Vioxx suits. It was approved by the FDA. It caused heart attacks. And what ended up happening is there were a lot of lawsuits, which were usually settled out of court against the company. But what it does, but there is some truth to the fact that the FDA approval process means that the drug companies don't have to worry about their reputation. You see, before the amendments were passed, and the amendments really changed the way pharmaceutical companies do business, before the amendments were passed, it was very important for a company to have a good reputation, because doctors would hesitate when a new drug came out to prescribe it if the company wasn't reputable. And a lot of the companies advertised, hey, you know, our drug has never had this particular kind of side effect and things like that, to, you know, attract the attention of prescribers. So it's very important to maintain a reputation when you have a certification system or a system that isn't highly regulated. But once it's highly regulated, everybody believes whatever the FDA says. And, you know, you talked about the pharmaceutical companies having influence on the FDA, and that is true, maybe not in the way most people think of it. But back in 92, it took so long for the FDA to look at all the data that the pharmaceutical companies send it and approve the drug, that they started something called the Prescription Drug User Fee Act. Basically, this allowed companies to pay $100,000 and get a faster review. Now it's $2 million. And so now what happens is the section of the FDA that deals with drug approvals has half their salaries paid for by the pharmaceutical companies. So, for example, when one of the regulators said to their supervisor, hey, we should not approve Vioxx, it could be causing heart attacks, we need more studies, the supervisor said, well, wait a minute, the American people are not our clientele. The drug companies are. They pay our salaries. So you can see, wow. Yeah, you can see what happens. So, you know, it's, when you, and this happens really whenever you have stringent regulation, because the only way some industries can survive under that level of regulation is to somehow co-opt the regulators. And that's exactly what's happened to the pharmaceutical companies.
Right. Wow. So, yeah, I mean, and like, you know, I hear like, oh, it's going to take $2 million to get something fast track for approval. And I already know, like, there's so many expenses that go into these drugs, and then you have like you know, the story of, you know, like going back to snake oil or fish oil or something like that. It's like those I'm sure were created like such a long time ago that none of this existed, that it was, you know, it could have been fishermen, farmers, you know, whatever it was, kind of experimenting with different foods and seeing what worked. And then it just kind of became a thing. And it wasn't like somebody like invented, you know, fish oil, vitamin B, you know, so like someone didn't have to spend $5 million to find out that eating vegetables was good for you. It's really insane. And like, it's kind of, we're all kind of like normalized to it now, where it's just like, well, yeah, they're playing with chemicals and they have to test them on people. But it's like, so let me ask you this. Do you know, like, going back like maybe 100 years in this country, and I know the pharmaceuticals were simpler then, what did the process used to look like before, I don't know, maybe before the FDA or before like government had this heavy hand in regulating pharmaceuticals?
Well, what happened is in 1938, the FDA got some power to regulate safety. And that's what it had going until the 1962 amendments. The 1962 amendments changed a lot of things. First of all, it let the FDA dictate what animal studies had to be done before human studies could be done, and then what human studies had to be done to get an approval, and how the manufacturing had to be set up, and what advertising was allowed or disallowed, and also, the FDA examiners finally had to sign on the dotted line, yes, I approve this drug. You see, before 1962, if the drug companies sent their data to the FDA doesn't do any testing itself. It just reviews the data submitted by the pharmaceutical firms. And when it reviewed that data, if it didn't object in 6 months, then the drug company could market the drug. But once the FDA has to sign, somebody in the FDA has to put their name on the approval document, you know, they're putting their neck in the proverbial noose, because if a drug has a side effect, and they all do, let's face it, and it comes to the attention of the American public, Congress ends up getting a lot of hate mail because they allowed this drug on the market, so the Congress then beats up on the FDA. And so the FDA, if it only approved drugs that were totally safe and totally effective, it would approve no drugs at all.
Right.
So what it does instead is it's added about roughly 10 years to the development time of a new drug, so that if Congress calls them on the carpet, they can say, oh, okay, well, you know, we did all our due diligence. We asked for all these studies. And so, you know, we can't be blamed. And the truth of the matter is, prior to the amendments, when a drug was approved and was seen to have bad side effects and withdrawn from the market, that was about 2.5% of the drugs. After the amendments, that number went to 3.3%, which probably really isn't different from 2.5%. But you can see it didn't go in the direction that the amendments promised. The amendments promised that more safety and effectiveness would be occurring. And so that number should have gone down, but it didn't. If anything, it went up. So you can see that even with all of these extra years, we still are having to withdraw quite a few drugs from the market, about 3.3%. So,
wow.
And you know, it's just what, you know, we just don't have enough scientific knowledge to always be able to tell until large numbers of people take the drug, because there's always going to be a subpopulation of people whose genetics or diet or whatever just clash with the drug, you know, and creates problems. And that's why if you don't need a drug, you shouldn't take it. You know, you should be careful what you take, because every drug can have a side effect. And today, you know, there's a lot of prescriptions being given to a single person. You know, a person can have, especially a senior, can have a couple dozen drugs that they're taking every day. And, you know, your body has a hard time with that, especially if you're taking it for years or even decades.
Yeah, absolutely. I actually just went through that with my my grandmother. She just turned 100.
For her.
Yeah, a few weeks ago. So, but she basically she was on a lot of different medications, and she was moved into a nursing home where a doctor had to review her, and basically said like, this is crazy. There's way too many like and the dosages on some of these are way too high. So he basically ended up taking a lot of them away. And you know, nothing. Well, one of them, I guess she had kind of her. It was a seizure medication, and it they decided that they didn't want to take it all the way away. They wanted to leave a little bit, but they reduced the dose a lot. And it's interesting. It's like, I guess this it's kind of like a I'm going on a different tangent, but it's interesting that like you know it's. Like you were saying, there's all these different drugs, but it's like, yeah, sometimes it's easier to just give them to quote unquote be safe, but is that actually being safer, or is it creating more problems? So that's and you know, finding the finding a doctor that has the time to you know review every patient and the chemistry and keep up to date with that, I'm sure is just next to impossible because there's so many people and so few doctors.
And of course, that's because of regulations too, but regulations on medical licensing laws.
Right, I was just going to ask because I think where did I read that? I can't recall where I read it, but there's so there's restrictions on things like so from what I understand, there's a lot of people who migrate to the US who are from either India or the Philippines, and they're doctors. But when they get here, they can't practice because they're not certified in the US. And for them to become certified in the US, they have to go all the way back to med school and start from scratch again, or some pretty complicated process.
Yeah, it is complicated. I don't think they have to go all the way back to medical school, but they probably do have to do a fellowship or residency or both. And you know, those are they're both like 2 to 3 years long. It's very long hours. It's very punishing. In fact, California at one point actually passed a law saying doctors couldn't work more than 70 hours a week. So that kind of tells you how bad it can be.
Yeah, it's and you know like I mean I know there's a lot of different factors that go into the cost of healthcare but you know like you said that's it's the regulation that's actually the exact same example you gave with the electricians. The fewer there are, the higher the prices go. And then of course
Exactly.
you have a lot of people trying to you know do the do-it-yourself medication. Like I mean I've you know a lot of people whenever the word cancer comes up, like a lot of people who are into the marijuana cures cancer crowd will tell people like, yeah, don't take any of the drugs, just take marijuana. And it's like, that might be helpful, but like without, like, I mean, what are you gonna just do this without like x-rays and like, I mean, the doctors do have some knowledge and they do have tools and they can see what's going on a little bit better than just telling someone to take some marijuana and solve the problem. But it's like it's you know just like the electrician example, if somebody finds out they have cancer and it's like okay I have to I don't have insurance I have to pay $20,000 for every single doctor's visit versus you know I'll just smoke pot until I die, then people are going to take that option, and that's kind of scary.
And you know, cancer, even though heart disease and stroke, I should go back and say the three major causes of death in this country are cardiovascular disease, like heart attacks. Stroke is number three, and number two is cancer. But cardiovascular disease and stroke have been cut by about 50%, 50, 50% in half over the last few decades. But cancer, not so much. And part of that is the FDA, even before the amendments were passed, was quite belligerent towards doctors who invented what they believed was a cancer treatment. And they didn't just tell them no, they prosecuted them. They tried to throw them in jail. And it's maybe not surprising. In fact, here in Texas, Dr. Brzezinski, who
I've heard
has,
of him.
he's in his 70s now. Yeah, he's been prosecuted multiple times by both the FDA and the Texas Medical Board. He says the two are in cahoots. That's probably right. And so what happens is he's spent a lot of time in court and a lot of money in court. He's prevailed, but you know, all that money could have gone into research. And the FDA actually came down on him hard one time, and the judge said, well, you need to get together with the FDA and do some protocols. So he has multiple protocols for his patients, but the FDA restricts, you know, whether he can treat them in the early stages or whether they have to exhaust all the, you know, typical chemo and radiation before they can get his treatment. So obviously by the time that happens, they're probably a lot closer to death. But a lot of patients claim that he has cured them of cancer, and they basically, I think there were like 67 of them or something that gave the latest judge letters saying, hey, you know, this guy saved my life. And even the judge in the court had told the Texas Medical Board, hey, if we take this guy's license away, because that's what they wanted to do to him, you know, people are going to die. This guy's saving lives. So obviously it's very, it's convincing enough for a judge. So it's sad. I mean, it's sad that people are prosecuted for trying to help people.
Right. And that actually goes back to like, to the placebo question. Let's say even if he's curing people by placebo, and let's say that the FDA, like they basically disavow his practice. They say we've got, like, you know, we think it's all witch doctor voodoo. Like it's all placebo. It's doing nothing. Shouldn't it still be somebody's right to say, well, I believe in it, so I want to try it?
Sure, of course. That's individual liberty. You know, my body, my choice.
Right. So I think it's like fascinating that, like, even to that extent, you know, I just feel like, I don't know if this has happened, but I just feel like even if all of those patients would have gone into the court and said, you know, yeah, I don't care if it was placebo, it worked, and so I had that right to choose that. If, like, judges would even say, like, okay to that, or if they would be like, well, no, it's not actually working, you just think it is.
It depends on the judge, obviously, because, you know, one of the problems we have is that, you know, the prosecutor and the judge are, you know, both government employees, basically. Right. So there's, you know, there's a tendency to, I think, to side somewhat, have a bias, shall we say, with the prosecutor. And I've seen this myself. I've been in court a number of times for various things, and it just, you know, it seems like that is indeed the bias. So I'm not saying that all judges are like that or that they would intentionally do that, but it's just kind of the way it comes down. So it's very hard to it's very hard to go into a court and not feel like you're going to lose, even if you win, because it's so expensive. And this is part of the problem. So it costs $2.5 billion on average to put a new drug on the market. And this includes the cost of failures. You know, most drugs fail. So you have to kind of include that in the price tag for the drug that finally makes it, right? So no doctor is going to have $2.5 billion. And even if he guesses right the first time, it's still close to $1 billion to get a new drug to market. So, you know, single doctors don't really, even a group practice would have a hard time coming up with that kind of money for a new treatment. And that's probably why the FDA doesn't like them, because they want to have these extra 10 years of studies so that they can show due diligence if Congress gets on their case. And while I appreciate that and understand that, obviously, when people are dying because of it, it's not a good thing.
Right. Yeah. It's like, like if they want no responsibility, it's like all they have to do is just stand back and put their hands up and say, we have nothing to do with this. We're not approving it. If you want to take it, it's at your own risk.
Yes.
And it's fascinating to me how it's not just in the government, like, it's, I mean, maybe it's all rooted in that, but I see that so many times where, you know, people, they're afraid to let people do things at their own risk. Like, you know, it's, if you're going to do something around me, I don't care if you agree to take full responsibility for everything. I don't want you to do it because that's, you know, that's the rules or that's what I came up with. It's insane. And it's like, but you don't have the right to control other people like that.
Well, yes, the arguments against right to try was, oh, if these patients take a drug that isn't fully tested, they could die. They could die earlier. They could suffer more. And yeah, they could, but they're going to die and suffer. I mean, if they're terminally ill, anyhow. So if they want the chance,
I mean,
recognizing the risks, they should be able to do it.
yeah, you could say that about skiing. I mean, if you go skiing, there's a good chance you're going to die sooner than if you don't go skiing. But we don't go around telling people that we need to ban skiing.
Yeah, we're
Or
skydiving.
yeah, or do like a 10-year study on it. So tell me, like, so you consider yourself a libertarian, right? It sounds like
Oh,
it.
of course.
Okay,
Yes.
so what kind of brought you to that? Like, what's your story? Because I think we all have a story of we were just kind of minding our own business one day and got hit in the head with a brick of government.
Well, actually, I haven't been really hit in the head by the government directly. When I was in college, I read Ayn Rand, and I had some friends that were really into her, so we'd go back and forth and back and forth. And at the time, I had just come out of 11 years of Catholic schooling, and even though I wasn't a Catholic, at least didn't consider myself a Catholic anymore, or maybe not even a believer. I was kind of exploring to see where I needed to be. But one thing that resonated with me and I kept with me was this idea of loving your neighbor. I felt as if that was a good working rule for me. And so that's something I tried to practice. And in doing so, I felt like, well, we should help the poor. But then it hit me. It hit me that people might be selfish and not want to help the poor. And, that was kind of bad. But what was even worse is if I took a gun and put it to their head and say, you will help the poor, that was an even ho more horrible act than selfishness. That was actually committing violence against someone. And that was a lot less loving. So once I came to that conclusion, it was like I was a libertarian. And I thought, oh, okay. I don't believe in taxes. I think taxation is theft. But I do think, that maybe the taxes help the poor. And I thought that until I actually worked with the poor. And once I started working with the poor, I saw things entirely differently. Because what I was doing is I was renting housing, and I found out that most of the people who were on welfare were actually able-bodied. And a lot of them chose to go on welfare in one way or another. I mean, I actually had a couple that made the decision to go on welfare so they'd have a lot of extra time. They wouldn't have a lot of money. They got that, but they were okay with that. I had another lady that had three children, and she was a really sweet lady. And she took me aside one day and said, you know what, Mary? You work all day at Upjohn, and then you come here and work on the apartments. And what you need to do is have children get on welfare and be able to rest.
Oh, wow.
And I'm like, oh, wow, yeah. So, and then the saddest thing, though, for me was the fact that I'd get young high school women who were pregnant and decided to have the child. And they'd come to me and say, okay, in 2 months or so, when I have the child, I'll be getting a welfare check. I can rent this apartment from you. And then they'd rent the apartment and realize that the welfare check was not enough for a baby to take care of a baby. So they'd have another child because the check would be bigger. And then a third child. And then after the third child, you didn't get any more money for the fourth child. So by the time these women were 21, they went, oh, I'm going to be poor the rest of my life unless I get a job. So I need to go to work. But they had no high school diploma. They had three children by then. So unless they had a mother or an aunt or somebody who could take care of the children, they really were in a tough spot because an entry-level job for somebody without a high school diploma is not going to include childcare. So the only way they could make ends meet is to have a relative take care of their children. If they could persevere for 2 years, they would be well on their way because the raises and everything would then, be better than what they were getting on welfare. But unfortunately, most of them didn't have someone who would take care of the children. And so they would try to get a job and quickly realize that at least for the first couple of years, they'd be better off on welfare. And so they gave up the job, went back on welfare, and were stuck forever in the poverty trap. And so what this does is it actually encourages our young people to make very poor financial decisions, you know, decisions that are going to really change the way their life is lived. And I find that very, very unethical and very disturbing, because also in Michigan, where I was renting these apartments out, if the father or children lived with you, you couldn't get welfare. So it broke up what would have normally been a family structure. Wow. Yeah. So, and it was very sad to see, because most minorities actually had a very strong family structure until welfare came along. And that was very scary too.
Wow. So that's like the, they say there's free cheese in a mousetrap. And the story about the woman you were just telling, like that it's exactly that. It's, you know, here's the welfare program. And like, I know like a lot of people, especially in like the libertarian movement, they spend a lot of time cursing people for taking welfare, but it's like, the way I look at it, it's almost like you can't blame them. It's like, it's like someone set out free cheese for them and they were like, hey, free cheese. And they didn't realize it was a mousetrap, and they didn't realize it was your cheese that they were stealing. But it's really fascinating to see that's an exact example of where the, you know, don't feed the bears, because they become dependent on that food and they can't survive on their own anymore. That's really sad.
Well, and if they're ever forced to survive on their own, and to some extent welfare recipients are, then bad things are going to happen. And what normally happens is they get money elsewhere. And that elsewhere can be sometimes from selling their bodies or selling drugs or something else, because it's really not enough to live on. And that's the other sad thing. About 2/3 of our welfare budget doesn't go to these people who need help. It goes to people, you know, basically goes to the middle class social workers who administer the program. And with private charity, it's just the opposite, right? So in the private charity, about 2/3 of the money, and sometimes as much as 80%, go to the people that you want to help. And only a small percentage go to the people who are administering the program, because a lot of it's volunteers or people working at a pretty low wage just because they want to help out. So it's very sad to see basically our money wasted, because whenever we supply anything through taxes, what ends up happening is we weaken our economy. If you look at charts that show government spending versus how much wealth we create every year, you find that the more government spends, the lower wealth creation is in that country. And that really hurts the poor, because when you don't have a lot of wealth creation going on, then the standard of living for everybody falls. And let's say it falls 10%. Well, for rich people, that means they can't buy a yacht. Big deal. But for the poor, it might mean the difference to be able to go to the dentist or to have food for dinner or something else, because they're living on the edge. Right. So when you try to do something through taxes and government spending, the people who really get hurt are the disadvantaged.
Right. Now there's an interesting, I know a lot of people say, oh, all the people on welfare are on drugs and they're using the money for drugs. And so there's, yeah, I know it's not true at all. But so there was I think Florida most recently tried the program where they were going to drug test, and that was supposed to like get everyone off the program to say, hi, you're failing, but everybody was passing. Vermont tried something that was totally different. I think it was either Vermont or New Hampshire. I think it was Vermont, where they said, okay, if you're on welfare, but you're able-bodied, we're giving you money, so you have to work for it. And so they did like, I guess it was like a community service type thing. And everyone basically said, well, if I have to work for it, I might as well get a regular job and make some real money. And so they dropped like 60 or 80% of everyone that was on the welfare program. They went out and got jobs. So it's kind of like,
yes,
it's, you know, like you said earlier, like when you force them to do it, sometimes they do it, but it's, you know, it still goes back into that situation where if they they're in a really bad position, they don't have a high school diploma, and they had kids to increase their welfare check, then it might make that harder. But yeah, that's all really fascinating. Yeah. Anyways, I'm really excited about your book, and I'm definitely going to pick up a copy and check it out. I recommend the same for anyone who's watching. Any final words you want to throw in?
Well, I guess I'd just like to encourage your listeners, if they want some, free writings of mine. I have it in my website, ruart.com. The 1993 version of Healing Our World is available there to read. And, you know, I encourage your listeners to go there and check out the free stuff, some free videos. And of course, obviously, you can buy my books there as well. But the important thing is that, you know, we all kind of learn from each other. So I'm hoping you'll find a lot of useful things there.
Awesome. And also, taxation is theft. All right.
Yes.
It's been great talking with you. Hopefully we'll do this again sometime.
Yes, it would be great. And thanks for having me on the show, and good day to all your listeners.
Anytime.